Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Stephen Grant. I'm a distinguished professor of sociology and public policy at the University of California, Riverside in the US.
And Steve, it's great to see you. We started working together 20 years ago, but I've not seen you for a long time, like about 10 years, probably more. And it's a real privilege and honor to have you with us today. I'd like to kick things off by inquiring if you would share with us what's currently preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you.
Yes, well, so very recently, well, let's say over the last year or so, maybe a bit more, I have been extremely interested in conflicts that are occurring in the United States, but also elsewhere, around issues of state power, diversity, and academic freedom. These issues have really come to a head in the United States. And quite a lot of my research recently has been about both what's happening on the right, especially what's happening on the right to try to regulate and control what can be taught in universities, and also the administrative offices that are concerned with diversity. And then to some degree also what's happening on the left in terms of trying to promote increasing diversity and the threats that sometimes occur because of that to the climate for discourse. And so those have been obsessions. There are some other obsessions as well, and I'm sure we'll get into that. And before we go further, I want to thank you, Toby, for having me today, and looking forward very much to the conversation.
Oh, well, thank you, Steve. Yes, I mean, for those of us outside the US, as you say, these issues can be very poignant and very present. And they do seem to involve a strange dance of right and left around things like freedom of speech, where suddenly terms like cancel culture are used, and then they're applied in a derogatory way for the about the other side, and then everything gets flipped around, and the people who want freedom of speech suddenly don't actually.
Yes, it's true. One of the things that's very interesting that I discovered from my visits to what they call in the United States the red states or the conservative states. I spent some time in Florida, which is kind of at the forefront of the right-wing reaction. And one of the interesting things is the claim that these divisive concepts that are included sometimes in courses where there's discussions of white supremacy, let's say, or the subordination of marginalized populations, that those are harmful to white students. And it's that same kind of psychology of harm that we've seen on the left, where there's discussions that some things that are stated, microaggressions are harmful to the sensibilities of these marginalized populations. So it seems like there's a lot of borrowing at the psychological level to complain about what's happening in universities. So I think it's true that you get a mirror image in some ways. And of course a big thing is that the right has used some dramatic anecdotes that they have been able to identify about cancel culture. And they have used those dramatic events to push a much broader policy agenda that could really lead to a big changes in the organization and regulation of universities in the United States. the Trump administration now, if there is a second Trump administration, they are working with many foundations on the right side of the spectrum, the Heritage Foundation and Manhattan Institute and others on the right, to come up with a bunch of policies which would be quite different for what we've encountered in the past. For example, conditioning federal funding for financial aid and for research on having intellectual diversity on campus, whatever that might mean in the eyes of the government. Also, changing the way universities are accredited so that certain things that the right would like to see, like intellectual diversity, again, however that may be defined, also lower levels of student indebtedness, being and labor market opportunities being embedded in accreditation standards. There's a trim that also taking universities to court if they are not complying with the recent Supreme Court decision on affirmative action. There's already investigations of many universities in the United States for not doing enough to combat anti-Semitism in the wake of the Israel-Hamas war. So there's a very big policy playbook that's developed by foundations, and then there's a search for a dramatic event to launch
Yes.
the policy framework, and they've discovered some of these dramatic events. Some of your listeners may be aware of the hearings that occurred last fall, where three Ivy League presidents were called in to talk about anti-Semitism on their campuses, and they were grilled. But it's not just about any anti-Semitism that may exist on college campuses. It's about making universities look bad so
Yes.
that big changes that a second Trump administration may want to put in place can occur. And so it's there's a constant search for these kinds of dramatic media events that can delegitimize universities and lead and help the lead to change. So that's, I've been very obsessed with this. Like I said, I visited Texas and Florida and listened to hundreds of hours of committee hearings and also floor debate in the legislatures, talked to people. And now I'm going to go to Indiana because they have now passed a bill which is probably the worst of the lot, which requires, well, people can be removed from tenured positions in the universities if they are not providing enough intellectual diversity in their classrooms. And it's not specified what that is, what that level ought to be, why in areas where there's settled knowledge, you need to have diversity of positions, what that diversity might entail. All of that is vague. So it's the possibility of political shenanigans is very high in a situation like that.
Well, I'm sure that all sorts of business schools are quaking in their boots as they're suddenly being required to teach critical race theory in order to appear diverse. So, Steve, part of this is a bit like that old Tom Lehrer line about the Spanish Civil War. They may have won the battles, but we had all the good songs, but in reverse. So, Javier Milei, the new Argentine president, has been on the path of craziness in the past week about Antonio Gramsci and the fact that Gramscian ideals and ideas have clearly animated the cultural left in its seizure of institutions, a bit like the old 19th century German socialist rallying cry of, seizure of institutions. And it seems to me as though what the right has learned in the United States is that cultural politics and the idea of self-expression and the politics of spectacle should not be the province of the left. It should be their province. They've learned from the left, and now they're going to use it. And when I think back to January 6, 2021, and the way in which the left suddenly becomes all in favor of the FBI, the police, law and order, and opposition to sedition, it's about the fact that these bastards picked up on something that we never quite managed.
I do agree that there's a lot to that, Toby. I think expressive politics, if you want to put it that way, or the politics of spectacle, it's a huge factor in the United States on the right now, and you can see this virtually every day in the Trump rallies, and you can also see it in the disruptions of meetings. During the COVID period, there was a lot of disruptions of school board meetings, for example, where you had parents, angry parents, jumping up and down about mask mandates and vaccine mandates. And so, the power of images, spectacular takedowns, violent language, all of that has become a pretty much of a staple in the on the right in the United States. It's of course there's some of this on the left as well. And I wonder whether the two, in some ways they reinforce each other. But so, for example, yesterday I was tuning into a discussion of free speech on campus, and Carol Crist, who's the current chancellor at UC Berkeley, and Condoleezza Rice, who you'll remember from the Bush administration, were sitting on stage, and they were able to talk for about half of the time because there was so much disruption and spectacle. And of course, on the left now, that's mostly for the Palestinian cause, and that's what happened yesterday. So there's a real, I guess there's, this has always been around. Spectacle, violence, or sort of at least symbolic violence, has always been around. I guess it ebbs and flows to some degree, and sometimes it's more prevalent on the right than sometimes on the left. But right now, we seem to be in a period where it's quite prominent on the right, and they're getting some political mileage out of it. And I don't know whether I do think that you're right, actually, that some people on the right did read Gramsci. I think I remember hearing that, generation back, some of the main figures on the intellectual of the right were reading Gramsci. So, because they did feel that the kind of winning the battle of culture was as important or more important than winning policy battles, and of course that's been a pretty prevalent theme on the left too, since Gramsci, and certainly all kinds of issues about consciousness raising, developing a narrative and repeating it over and over again, embedding it as much as possible in the imagery and speech. All of that is very evident in, on all sides of the on both sides of the political debate, and have been for a long time. But the, I think it's, I believe it was, I'm not sure about this, but Paul Weyrich, who was like a right-wing figure in the 80s, and Irving Kristol, another right-wing former Trotskyist who became a prominent figure on the right, I believe that they were quite familiar with Gramsci.
Well, all over Latin America, the idea of the national popular that was so crucial to his discourse has been adopted for ever by people who are of all political persuasions. I remember being asked to go to a meeting about 20 years ago because it was thought the left would win the next presidential election in Mexico. And there was going to be a meeting to talk about forming future cultural and specifically media policy. Because of flight conditions, I arrived rather late. I walked in, trying to be very silent and so on, as you do when you're very late for something. And I heard people citing Benjamin and Gramsci, and I thought, oh Christ, what am I doing here? Just a bunch of academics wanking on. Not realizing that one of them was a member of the House of Representatives and the other was a senator. And one was center left and the other was right. I mean, very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
I
So it
wanted to
does,
sorry, go
go
ahead.
ahead, please.
Now, I wanted to ask you particularly about sociology in all of this, because one of the things that I've not fully understood, haven't grasped properly, relates to one of your field sites, Florida, is that I gather it's a kind of bete noire for DeSantis and his crew.
Could you repeat it, Toby? I didn't quite catch that.
Sorry, I don't understand this fully, but my understanding is that sociology has become a bit of an object of hatred and fear for Ron DeSantis and his crew. So I wondered if you could explain a bit about that. And also tell us a bit more about your field work in Florida.
Yeah, sure. Well, in fact, in Florida, since you mentioned it, there is the there was something recently passed where they were disallowing the teaching of sociology in as part of the general education curriculum that all students are exposed to in Florida colleges and universities. And the argument is that sociology, like some other fields, has been captured by ideologues. Of course, nobody on the right is an ideologue, according to the governor of Florida. But so there's that. I mean, of course, this is just part of a political campaign. I think that, I mean, my personal view is that if you look at the journals, the sort of the main journals in sociology, you would see very sophisticated statistical methods and a wide range, relatively wide range of topics. I do think that the discipline has, well, this is a matter that one would have to really look into, but it seems to be the case that publicly, at least, sociology is associated with studies of inequality, and maybe especially gender and racial inequality. Those are obviously extremely important topics, but they're a subset of all the interesting things that sociologists do. And so you won't hear the governor of Florida talking about interesting studies of social networks or organizations or political economy, the global system, or how educational institutions operate, or how to improve communications between doctors and patients, or anything, any one of the, thousands of topics that would come under the sociological gaze, if you will. And I think the question is whether the discipline has gravitated to a higher concentration of topics on gender and racial inequality, and has tended to ignore to a greater degree other topics than it has in the past. And insofar as that's true, if it is true, I don't know that it's true, but insofar as it's true, then it gives a little bit of credence to the governor of Florida's concern that not about ideological capture so much, but about a narrowing of topics and topics that probably he doesn't like very much. I think that I mean I've been doing a content analysis of the two main theory journals in sociology, and I can there's almost nothing in those theory journals about racial or gender inequality. I mean, there's a wide range of topics that are considered, but there are hardly any on that on those topics. So, I mean, there's so I think that again, I think it's an example of what you might say synecdoche, picking out a single example and painting a whole discipline. Again, a dramatic example, perhaps, and then painting a whole discipline with that brush. I'm quite sure that nobody, I mean, when you listen to these committee hearings, occasionally they will cite a study, but it's a cherry-picked study. It's one that supports the position of the person carrying the legislation. There's no effort whatsoever to do a comprehensive investigation or even the beginnings of a comprehensive investigation. For example, there's this widespread belief on the right that diversity, equity, and inclusion offices, which have become embedded in universities over the last couple of decades, are all about creating divisions on campus, institutionalizing a certain ideology that is related to white supremacy and the marginalization of racial minorities. Nobody has actually looked at what diversity, equity, and inclusion offices do. There may be some of that happening, but a lot of what they do is related to mentoring, support services for underrepresented students, counseling, tutoring, and they also, many of them have offices for veterans, military veterans, disabled people, disabled students. So the range of services can be fairly extensive. And it just, when you're an academic and you listen to politicians talk and they choose one or two examples to try to carry a pretty far-reaching legislation. It's very discouraging because you're used to trying to find out whether what you're saying is actually true. And that's not the deal now, at least with respect to regulation of universities in the United States. The deal is find something that seems to resonate with conservative audiences, find some dramatic events that you can hold up in the media, and develop model legislation to foster your policy objectives, claiming that these few events are in some way representative. And then, if you have a legislature that's majority Republican, and especially if it's a veto-proof majority, which is true in many conservative states now in the US, you are able to pretty much get anything through. And that seems to be the playbook. And unfortunately, the kinds of counters to that, the idea of academic freedom, it's a norm, it's not a law, and it's a pretty weak read. Actually, a lot of professors in the United States have lost academic freedom cases in the courts. I mean, I think that somebody told me, I haven't checked into this, but somebody told me that two-thirds of the cases that have been brought before the courts for academic freedom have yielded losses for the plaintiffs. So it's not like there's an extremely strong counter to what's going on now. And we really should be worried about it, though, because the climate for free inquiry and open inquiry is it's under attack now, and probably to a degree that's as extensive or more extensive, I think more extensive than the McCarthy era in the US in the 50s, when there were loyalty oaths and people were being investigated for ties to communism, and 100 professors or so lost their jobs, and others were silenced. It's at that level, in my opinion, and so it's worrisome for those of us who want the universities to be able to explore ideas wherever they may go, and independent of the sensibilities of politicians. Anyway, it's very interesting to listen to debates in committee meetings, because nothing that's said in those committee meetings could possibly get through a reasonable journal review in an
This is
academic press.
a classic case of an expression coined in the British Medical Journal 20 years ago. Something masquerading as evidence-based policy, but is actually policy-based evidence.
Yes, exactly. Precisely so.
Yeah.
We see a lot of that. Yes.
A quick bit of context here for folks outside the US, that education is constitutionally a state's responsibility in the United States. That said, as in so many areas of life, the federal government has had an expanded role in the last century and more, and especially because of the huge research funding that it gives through things like the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, and the impact of things like the Education Act. And some elements like Title IX that have produced greater diversity in all sorts of fields, all sorts of domains of endeavor. And so, on the one hand, the states do have a lot of authority. On the other, if Trump and his ilk do regain power, they never really worked out, because they're stupid and ignorant, how to operate the levers of federal power in their first period in office. But they have studied that and they know a lot more now. They would still find it difficult, but easier than before because they've learned things.
Well, it will depend to some degree on whether the Democrat, let's say he does come in and is reelected, if the Democrats hold one or both of the houses of Congress, it'll be much tougher for him to do things. But if they do happen to win both houses, right now the Senate looks like they could win, and the House could be close. So it's certainly possible. And in fact, the federal government is the biggest supplier of funds for research universities anyway, between financial aid and research funding, as you say. It's many hundreds of millions of dollars, which could theoretically be conditioned on conformity to some policy directive. So it's worrisome in that way. I mean, it does, maybe I'll take a little bit of a turn. It's not much of a turn here, Toby, but the other thing that I've been thinking about, although I haven't yet written about it, is related in a way. I think when you live in the United States, and this would be true of other countries as well, you're impressed with the kind of increasing irrationalism of the world. And, you know, of course, in sociology, we're very much in thrall of Max Weber's idea of the rationalization of the world. It's becoming much more predictable. Scientific expertise is taking over. Bureaucracy has these categories that are rationally organized, and the whole world is the kind of becoming disenchanted, as Weber said, and subject to rational control. And of course, it's must have seemed that way in Weber's time. And in some ways, it's also true, I guess, at the cultural level, where you know, academics have moved into every field under the sun, created categories of understanding, in some way rationalized a wide range of topics, and allowed them to be inspected by the whole community in some standard way. And so the idea, I mean, throughout, religion has been kind of a counter to rationalization, because, you know, you've got the distinction, the conflict between reason and revelation. But in addition to that, you know, there just seems to be, you sort of feel like the community, or the community that's interested in exploring the world using logic and empirical evidence and so forth, is shrinking, and these other tendencies have gotten more pronounced. And I think, you know, one thing that has always been there, of course, is that economic and political power has always been kind of a obstacle to rationality. And, you know, we see that constantly. I mean, even just in the press the other day, the Boeing airline company was in trouble because they had production pressures that overcame their safety concerns, and they weren't building their planes in a rational way because they're trying to get them out quickly and make money. And of course, that happens quite a bit, you know, with the also we can think of the opioid crisis in the US and so on. But there seem to be some additional things going on that raise the concerns about the irrationalization of the world rather than the rationalization of the world. One of those things is the motivated use of disinformation, where you can make political gains by flooding the zone, so to speak, with misinformation and making your opponents look terrible, and also lying about your opponents. And of course, we're seeing that not just with the Trump movement in the United States, but Putin and many, many others, and many, many other autocrats. And it seems like social media is somehow conducive to the to this motivated use of disinformation. We also see this kind of new Gnosticism, you might say, where you've got conspiracy theories bubbling up all over the place, and people who think that they have secret knowledge that cannot be that's better than the knowledge of experts, even though it can't be rationally evaluated by people outside of the group or the sect. You have, you know, I think you also have a kind of culture of anti-elitism that is very strong, both on the left and the right, which is part of this whole complex. And then you have the failure of experts that play into it. I mean, they're experts do get things wrong, and so and they get things wrong on a fairly regular basis. As anybody who looked at the war in Iraq that was launched by the United States in 2003, or even more recently, all the school closures in the United States, which during COVID, which apparently were not probably necessary and had some really negative consequences. But, you know, that's an example of where not all the evidence was in, and people went on their best thinking at the time, and that best thinking turned out not to be correct, perhaps. So it just seems like we've got this kind of wicked brew of all of these different phenomena, which are creating more challenges for people who would like to pursue public issues or even scholarly issues in the spirit of reason and empirical investigation and so on. So that's another it's something I've been thinking about. Was Weber actually, you know, in what ways was he right? And in what ways do we see these counter tendencies that are perhaps even growing due to technology and people understanding how politics works on a cultural level better than they once did? Anyway, that's. I don't know whether you want to touch that one or not, but
Well, no,
that's
I think
another.
that's very important. I think about disenchantment and reenchantment almost every day. And this was something that I thought was a settled business and quite teleological 30 years ago, and how wrong I was. How wrong I was. So I think that's an extremely valuable insight. I'd like, if I could for a moment, though, Steve, to drag us back to education and to a prize-winning book that you wrote, came out about 5 years ago. Two Cheers for Higher Education, where you have some criticisms, but you also say universities are stronger than ever and they have great resilience. Now, this is not meant to be a gotcha moment. People have only listened to this, but can't see the look on your face, which is a mixture of shame, horror, and laughter. But here's a little, I'd love to hear you talk a bit about the book, but also explain whether things have changed. A little bit of context for this. My friend Michael Deli Carpini recently retired as a dean at University of Pennsylvania, wealthy Ivy League private. And he said to me when we recorded the podcast that without there being any element of Schadenfreude, as he looked around him during his decennial period and saw public universities in the United States being bullied by right wingers, he
By
thought
whom?
by right wingers in state government and in the feds. He thought, this is terrible. At least it can't happen to us. How wrong he was, as he went on to say. So I wonder if you could take us back to that book, which was the product of many years of research, and justly it's won at least three prizes that I'm aware of. What its argument was,
Yeah,
and
so
whether things
now
are far different now.
sometimes, Toby, I feel like I should have said one cheer instead of two cheers for higher education, or on my worst days, I think maybe half a cheer. But it's, and what was really problematic is that we're stronger than ever. I think that, I guess you have to remember that I stopped that inquiry in 2015, and that is about the time that things are beginning to change. And even, I mean, I did some research after 2015, and book was published at the end of 2018, and it was already becoming clear to me that public faith in higher education was waning, and it was especially waning on the among conservatives in the United States. And that and I wrote about that, and I said there's one section of the book where I said, where I think the subhead was storm clouds gathering, and I talked about some of the reasons why there was declining faith in higher education. Cost was a big issue. Indebtedness for some, big issue. There were quality concerns about, were the college classes really being taught at college level? And but a big thing also was this idea of ideological capture by the left. This was something the right was very worried about. Even beginning, you started to see the change right about in 2015, and it's just continued to go down. We also, since that time, and I've written a paper about this with a graduate student, Ben Fields, about the disruption in higher education enrollments. Now, most of that disruption has been at the lower level of the system in the United States. This is strictly about the US. Community colleges lost a huge chunk of enrollment. For-profits lost a lot of enrollment, partly because of regulation that was put in under Obama. The kind of the more fragile Four-year colleges that are not research universities have had trouble. Some of the small religiously affiliated colleges have had trouble. Where you haven't seen trouble is in research universities, and the kind of the top layer of li liberal arts colleges, which is a U.S. kind of institution. But many of them are very wealthy and do recruit among high-income people by and large. So those parts of the system look pretty stable, and you might say they're even still stronger than ever. I mean, we do. I think there are some. You know, there definitely been attacks, and there's. Your friend at the University of Pennsylvania, to his chagrin, has became very aware of those attacks recently, and they're very motivated to continue this as we've been talking about. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there's a tremendous amount of research that's being produced, some of it of great import in universities. I mean, I looked into the most important inventions for a period of time, and about half of them can't were either began in universities or universities had a tremendous influence on them. Right now, quantum computing, gene editing, AI, all of that stuff is very. I mean, we can have mixed feelings about some of it. I have mixed feelings about certainly about AI, but they're important developments anyway that have not exclusively their roots in universities, but partly their roots in universities. I think even in terms of how we understand the world. For all of the criticism of gender studies and racial and ethnic studies on the right, we know a heck of a lot more about the circumstances, history, the condition of women and minoritized groups than we ever did, and non-Western groups and non-Western cultures than we ever did. Thanks to university scholarship, but beyond that, some of the ways that we understand the world really have come out of the universities. The idea of social capital or cultural capital, or the idea of emotional intelligence, transaction costs. I mean. Even the idea of gender, I found out, was pretty much it was launched by an academic book, so many years ago, of course. So there's just, I mean, our whole cognitive ways of understanding the world are very much influenced by university researchers. And so, I'm not in the camp of saying universities are in, really terrible, terrible shape here, and they could go the way of the dinosaurs. I don't, I mean, we could see a lot of restructuring, but there have been many efforts to restructure universities. And, not too long ago, people thought online universities were going to take over. That has proven not to be true. They've ended up being more of a supplement, more for adults, more for on-the-job training, and so forth, and a substitute for colleges and universities. So, I think there's a lot there. I think they've become more inclusive. I think on the net, that's been very positive. There there are weaknesses. There are weaknesses, and they have stronger enemies than they have had. We'll see what happens. I mean, I think that there are some things that would be extremely valuable. And I just wrote about this. I mean, as much as I'm a critic of what's happening on the right, with respect to universities, maybe they're doing universities a favor insofar as the climate for discourse could be more open, insofar as there might be overzealousness and some diversity, equity, and inclusion offices. You know, maybe that could use a bit of correction. And also, insofar as we're in a situation where students are not, partly because of COVID, haven't learned how to be students, and study and read. I think the latest statistics out of the University of California suggest that more than half of UC undergraduates do less than 50% of the reading for their courses, and only a small sliver do all of the reading for their courses. So, you know, they've become more clever maybe at finding information from the internet, but nevertheless, that there could be an argument could be made that there's been a de decay in the teaching and learning culture, which needs to be addressed as well. So it's not like, and I wrote extensively about this in Two Chairs. There's whole chapters about teaching and learning and about online education and the different storm clouds that I saw on the horizon at that time. But I think it's true that the period that I wrote about, 1980 to 2015, the other phrase I'm sorry I used, which I only used once, was a golden age. That's always subject to, you know, reasonable critique. And I regret using that term. But one could say that, I mean, if you look at the amount and quality of research that was produced by research universities at that time, the number of new important technological innovations that came out, the amount of good that universities did in terms of solving community problems and contributing to the cultural environment in their local communities. It's not a bad record. And yes, we have problems now, and I think many of those problems can be addressed, but it is getting to be very expensive to go to universities in the United States, and that's something that I feel like they're just going to need to be some serious attention to that. It's getting to be out of reach for people from lower income families, and so financial aid has to be reconsidered. But I'm still pretty optimistic. I'm not ready to throw in the towel, Toby. So I think, but it's definitely, I mean, you're 100% right to suggest that we're in a much more challenging time now, and it seems to be the case that sometimes we write books, and by the time we've done all of our research and finally written the thing, dotted all of our I's and crossed all our T's, we're at the cusp of a new era. And I think that was is arguably true of Two Cheers. So, but I think that the foundations, at least at research universities, are still quite strong, and I don't I don't see much real decay there. I mean, there's some problems, but they can be fixed.
I quite agree. It's a terrific book. And I think what we need is, I think it was Princeton that published it,
Yes.
to harass you to write a revised edition
Yeah.
in which maybe you, it's called 1.5 Cheers.
Yes.
And
Yeah, could be. Yes.
there's a little prefatory note or an epilogue in which you say, by the way, something happened in 2016, the roots of which are actually much longer standing. I guess one of the things I hold out as hope is that if you get beyond the highfalutin rhetoric of these idiots like DeSantis, public research one universities and non-research one universities in all the states of the US are huge engines of economic activity. And they have tentacles right across the ideological spectrum and right across the societies. And it's not just true of, powerhouses of liberalism, like, say, the University of Illinois, it's true of the University of Alabama. These engines,
Absolutely.
right throughout the infrastructure, the oligarchy of those places, they have connections. So if they have the right people on their boards of government, if they have the right people as their rectors or presidents or chancellors, they can sit down with some of these lawmakers and say, okay, you've done this. All right. You felt you needed to. Let me tell you what is actually going on and take you back to when, guess what? You were an undergrad or you did your law degree or whatever it was. But these things are so embedded in US society, especially at the level of the ruling class and not just the ruling class, that doing away with them would be almost inconceivable in terms of path dependency for legislators across the country. There are some to whom that doesn't apply, a Marjorie Taylor Greene, probably. But for the vast majority, including Trumpians, they're there, they're entangled in it.
Well, yes, I mean, I agree with that. And another thing I wrote about in the book is if you look at places like the University of Utah or the University of Colorado, the number of startup companies that have grown out of university research in those places, it's staggering. I mean, it's not just that they contribute to the cultural life, they also like you're suggesting, the economic life of their states are extremely connected. There's a wonderful book about the University of California and the California economy and places where you might not guess. I mean, obviously you would guess Silicon Valley, huge impact of Stanford and UC Berkeley, but the wine industry, the research at UC Davis had tremendous impact on the wine industry in California. And there's just, you can go up and down the state and find tremendous, both in, in 21st century industries and in 18th century industries. I mean, it's or 19th century industries in agriculture. So I think when politicians are getting on their hobby horse about the problems of universities, they're not looking at and they and mostly in the states, Florida is an exception. They realize that, and if governors, including Republican governors, they're not interested in shackling their public research universities. They just aren't. They're, if they want to cut, typically, and this is sad, but it's true, they typically cut community colleges, the 2-year colleges that serve more for occupational training purposes for students who often come from less advantaged homes. And that's where the budget cutting tends to go. So it's, I mean, it's cyclical because during recessions everybody gets a hit. But in general, they realize that it's not just for the economic contributions and cultural contributions, but also social mobility, keeping people in the state. There are all kinds of producing people who will pay taxes
Indeed.
rather than being on state grants and welfare. I mean, it's just they're tremendous engines for social and economic progress. So it's no surprise that the rhetoric often outstrips what's actually done with the purse strings.
Prof. Steve Print, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's been terrific reconnecting with you. I've really enjoyed it. I've always enjoyed our conversations, but this one in particular.
Yes. And likewise, Toby, it's wonderful to see you, and thanks again for inviting me.